Friday Night Wine Fight contains coarse language and adult themes. Listener discretion is strongly advised.
Welcome to Friday Night Wine Fight.
I'm Sarah.
I'm Amy.
And I'm Bianca. We are three Melbourne girls, if you didn't know already. And we also had nothing better to do than start a podcast. Like, what are we, crazy? Yeah, while we're down in lockdown in fucking Melbourne. But now we're free, which is super awesome. Still really haven't gone anywhere because kind of want to be locked down again.
That's straight out of lockdown.
Yeah.
Been here for years.
I'm institutionalized now.
Stockholm syndrome.
Yeah. Yeah. I can't remember what the syndrome is where you just keep going back to jail because that's the comfiest life for you. But that's how I feel.
You can't leave your house because everything outside is scary.
Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah. We take aim one topic each week and we try to make some sense of it. Ladies, what are we drinking tonight?
I'm drinking a liquid that's wet.
Pepsi. I'm drinking Pepsi Max again. That's pretty much all I drink now. Because I can't drink alcohol.
My life is depressing. I just love how it says something wet. My mind is something too dirty.
Don't be dirty.
Wet.
What
am I doing?
What are you, a 14-year-old boy? Come on.
Ah, I know.
I thought I was the one with the mind of a child. Shit.
Same. I thought I was that one too.
Nah, it's all
me. We all are. Well, I'm drinking the Butterfly Effect Cab Merlot because it's currently 12 degrees in my hood. And for our American friends, it's cold. I'm not doing the conversion. Just let's call it cold. Yeah.
Yeah. What is it? It's to convert back, you take 32 and halve it. So 12 minus 32 is like minus 20, and then half that is like minus 10?
Nah, got to go the other way because Fahrenheit is, it tends to be higher because when you've got a temperature of 37, that's
so
like 100 and something.
So you double it and add 32.
Yeah, it's too much mass for me today. Anyway, it's cold. Red wine.
Woo! And same. I'm drinking the Companions Shiraz Tempranillo. I've never had a Tempranillo. I don't think I have.
You've had Tempranillos before, but not by themselves. They're always a mix. And we usually have it when we're on our walkabout.
Yeah. I don't think they've been very good because it's not something that I've gone through the bottle store and like, ooh, a Tempranillo. I'm always like, no, and Shiraz, no.
Yeah, but that's what happens. Same with Drift. We've always tried them and we don't like them when we're on walkabout. So, yeah.
Yeah. But this is really nice. It's by Byron and Harold and from the Pyramids game.
Nice.
I can never leave, apparently.
Uh-huh. Yeah. We're in for life now.
Yeah, exactly. So, Sarah, without the way, what is our topic for tonight? Wing it, baby.
I kept forgetting I was doing the opening for this topic. Let's have some fun, people, with winging my intro.
Winging it just a little bit.
No, winging it a lot. Not just a little bit. A fucking lot. All right, so our topic tonight is secret aliases.
No.
Yeah.
It's not?
Secret identities. Remember we changed it? We had that whole conversation about why we had to change it.
Oh, okay. Well, doesn't really matter. Secret identities, secret aliases. It all falls really under pseudonyms.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's pretty much what we should have just called the episode. Because, so pseudonyms.
You have just nailed the reason why we didn't call it pseudonyms.
Yeah.
Because we can't say it every single time correctly.
Yeah.
That's fine.
So, yeah, they include, like, stage names, pen names, usernames, nicknames, aliases, superhero and villain identities, code names, mm-hmm. gamer yeah. identities, and the Pope.
Yeah.
Yeah. So they're pretty much just names that people use. Either they don't want people to know their real names or they don't like their real names. It happens.
It does. Yeah.
It does. Just a couple of famous people who do this. Marilyn Monroe, born Norma Jean.
Yeah.
Mortensen. Mm. Miley Cyrus.
Yep.
Destiny mm-hmm. Hope Cyrus.
Yeah.
Don't blame her.
And she Elton. Called Miley because when she was little, she was real smiley, and so Smiley became Miley.
Oh, I think I want to vomit. Elton John is Reginald Dwight, which, again, yes. yeah, just doesn't seem to roll off the tongue like Elton John.
Elton John fits really well for his pop star sort of life, but yeah. since he was knighted, Sir Reginald Dwight sounds really good. So, I don't know, could work.
And then you've got, like, all right, so the worst would have to be in Australia. No, our American listeners will have no idea. But from our teenage era, Andy G. Now he's Osher Ginsburg. Like, it went from.
Yes.
It was just Andy G. How much easier was that? And now we're at Osher. And every time I hear Osher, I'm like, who the fuck?
Is that his actual name? Is
yeah,
it?
He legally no. changed it.
Yeah. No, but, like, was that his name that he was born with? He adopted Andy G as a stage name because it was easier to say no. and it's reverted back. Is that what's happened?
No, he changed his name from Andrew, I'm pretty sure it was Andrew, to Osher.
I thought it was a stage name, Andy G. And then, like, he went to his real name.
No, I thought he changed his real name to Osher. Oh,
I don't know.
I would have to look into that. Some pen names. Samuel Clemens. He used a pen name for his entire career. People knew him as Mark Twain.
Oh
my God.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Richard Bachman, who released a lot of books, is really actually Stephen King.
Yep. Yeah. Yep. That one.
Yep. And that's all I have for those celebrities.
Love it.
Limited knowledge here.
Nailed it.
No, actually, I have, you know, what pseudonym derives from, which is a Greek word, which is pseudonym. I think that's how you say it. I've just Googled these people. I have not practiced this. So this is going to be all pronounced incorrectly. But that is, the literal translation means false name.
Yeah.
Oh.
And pseudos is lie or falsehood. And onoma is name, so false name.
Nice.
Pretty yeah. much. So, yeah, and the term alias is actually a Latin adverb meaning at another time or elsewhere.
Oh.
Yeah. So there's my quick Googling skills. Thank you for listening. Good night. So this week I have chosen to talk about Margarita Zelli. So
excited.
So this woman was born in, again, I have not practiced names. Leeuwarden? I'm going with that. Leeuwarden?
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 W's are more like V's because it's yeah. close to German. So Leeuwarden?
Yeah, in the Netherlands in 1876. She was the oldest of four. She had three younger brothers. Her father owned a hat shop and made some good investments in life, which good for him. And that led them to living a nice, cushy kind of life. That was until 1989 when the father went bankrupt. Yay! Oh. Bankruptcy! Mm-hmm. And her parents ended up divorcing 2 years later. Oh, and then 2 years later, her mum died.
Oh.
I don't know why. Just putting that in there. I don't know.
Speculate wildly, the father did it.
I was just thinking.
I didn't know this was a true crime app. I'm in. What happened?
It was like, you know, the 1800s and medicine was terrible. I'm going with she just died of a cold.
Probably a ghost in her blood. Yeah.
Yeah.
So yeah, and 2 years after that, the father remarried, and then the family fell apart. So Margarita was then sent to live with her godfather in Sneek, which is a province in Friesland. I'm going Friesland.
It's Friesland. It's the land of the fries.
It's the land of fries. Oh, I like fries. In the Netherlands. This is mainly in the Netherlands for her childhood, because that's pretty much where she lived. Where she actually studied to become a kindergarten teacher in Leiden, which is a province of South Holland. But fled her uncle's home in the Hue, which is on the west coast, after her godfather pulled her out of the school when the headmaster began to openly flirt with her.
Wait a minute. Why did she run away when her uncle slash godfather was trying to protect her from grossness?
Well, maybe he was overbearing.
Yeah, and she's probably like a high school student. So she was probably just like, could you just calm down? He like really likes me.
Yeah. Pretty much that's what I'm going with.
And her godfather went, nah, he's a creep.
Not happening. So at the age of 18, and you know what, later on it really does explain why she did really run away, what type of person she was to run away. So at the age of 18, she answered an advertisement in a Dutch newspaper placed by a Dutch colonial army captain, Rudolf McLean.
McLeod.
I know what I'm saying. Shut up.
I didn't say it wrong. You did.
I know. And I was correcting myself.
I was helping. Stop it.
Anyway, so, yeah, Rudolf McLeod. So he was born 1856, and I'm pretty sure he died in 1928.
Had good innings for that time.
Yeah. So he was living in what was then at the time called the Dutch East Indies, which is now Indonesia. And, yeah, he was looking for a wife. So she married him in Amsterdam on the 11th of July, 1895. Because, hey, why not marry a man that you met in a wanted ad?
It's worked for all those people who are victims of serial killers, so why not?
Yeah. Why not?
I know every time I see, do you like pina coladas? I'm like, yes. I'm
and
in.
Getting caught in the rain? Yes.
When can we meet? Yeah.
So, yeah, the marriage enabled her to move up in the Dutch upper class and place herself financially, like on financial stable ground. She moved with her husband to Malang on the east side of the island of Java, traveling out in May 1987. They had two children, Norman John McLeod and daughter Louise Jean McLeod, Jeanne McLeod. Her husband was the poster boy for why you shouldn't marry someone you found in the wanted section of the newspaper.
No.
Yes.
Really? It was really? Just this matchmaking.
The fact that he couldn't meet a nice lady in society normally, no.
And he was an army captain, so he would have had plenty of young fillies just looking so for somebody many. Like that. So,
And for some reason, those fillies just went, I've met you. No, sorry. So he was an alcoholic. I can't talk. Fuck me. He was an alcoholic.
Same.
And he physically beat her and blamed her for his lack of promotion.
Oh, so, yeah, fucking gaslighting too. Like, it's all her fault. Oh, fuck off.
And he also openly kept a concubine, but that was socially accepted. So,
what a cunt. Yeah.
In the Dutch East Indies at the time, that was acceptable. So she actually temporarily abandoned her husband and moved in with Dutch officer Van Reeds. During this time, she studied the local culture intensely. And they did mention it was an intense studying.
Mm.
Yes. I don't know how you study your culture intensely. Such intensity. Well, she did this for several months, and she also joined a local dance company.
Ooh, nice.
As you do.
Probably had a group on. Yep.
Yeah. Got to get a groove on. Exactly.
She went and went, oh, I've got a Groupon for this. Let me go and join. Yeah.
My best bitch bought it for me. Forced to dance.
Loved it.
Loved every second.
So it was during this time that she chose her artistic name of Matahari, the Malay word for sun, or the literal translation is eye of the day. So,
okay.
Yeah. So if anyone has ever heard of Matahari, it's not just a drink or a song. Okay? They were named after this person.
Oh.
So, like an idiot, she went back to her husband when he asked her to come home. But he hadn't changed. So she sought escape from her daily circumstances by studying her local culture. Tragedy struck, though, in 1899 when the kids fell ill from complications relating to the treatment of syphilis contracted from the parents.
The parents or the father?
Yeah, well, the thing is, the family claims that it wasn't because of the syphilis. It was because they were poisoned by a disgruntled servant or, like, enemies of the husband.
Oh, for fuck's sake.
Yeah.
Oh, well. Yep. I'm keeping all the comments in.
Yeah. Well, fortunately, the daughter survived, but their son, Norman, did not. After that, they moved back to the Netherlands and the couple officially separated on the 30th of August in 1902. The divorce didn't become final, though, until 1906. And Marguerite was awarded custody of their daughter, and the husband was legally required to pay child support.
Okay.
But he didn't.
Of course he didn't.
Yeah. So at one point, the daughter went to visit him and she never returned.
Oh.
Yeah. So Margarita, she couldn't afford the resources. She didn't have the resources to fight the situation to say, give me back my daughter. I have custody. She just came to visit you out of, you know, the goodness of her heart.
Yeah.
But so, yeah. So she accepted the fact that now the daughter lived with the husband.
Mm.
So she believed that while her husband was an asshole to her, he'd always been a good father. The daughter actually died, but years later, at the age of 21, supposedly complications related to syphilis.
That didn't exist. Yeah.
That didn't exist or kept existing. Who knows? There's so much syphilis flowing around those times.
Oh, back in those days, mate.
Ah, yeah.
Who didn't have it? I know, right? So in 1903, Zelly moved to Paris, where she performed as a circus horse rider using the name Lady MacLeod, much to the disappointment of her husband's family. Well, they were still technically married then, so her husband's family. So struggling to earn a living, she also posed as an artist's model, so, you know, nude modelling and such.
Oh, for the boudoir.
Mm. Yes. So still married by, you know, 1904. Mm. She began to rise as an exotic dancer under the name of Matahari. So promiscuous, flirtatious, and openly flaunting her body. She captivated her audiences and was an overnight success from the debut of her act at the Musée Guimet, I don't know how to say it, on the 13th of March, 1905. She became a longtime mistress of the millionaire Leon, I don't know how to say his name. Like, he was Leon Industrialist. God, I can't talk. Emile? Is it Emile? I don't even know how to say his name.
I'm not looking at your Guimet. Bit. I'm scrolled all the way down to mine, so I cannot help
Yeah.
you.
Yeah. Sorry.
I didn't want to spoil it by Emile. Reading it a lot.
I'm going with Emile. So
I'm just enjoying the carnage. I'm not helping.
Yeah. Don't help me. I'm just going to skip over trying to say his name because I don't want people to yell at me from France. So, yeah, he founded the museum, pretty much, or the musée.
Yeah.
I think it's a museum. I don't know. She posed as a Javanese princess of priestly Hindu birth. pretending to have been immersed in the art of sacred Indian dance since childhood. She was photographed numerous times during this period, nude or nearly nude. Some of these pictures were obtained by McLeod and used to strengthen his case in order to keep custody of their daughter, because, again, he still had the child at this point. Her act was successful because it elevated erotic dancing to a more respectable status and so broke new ground in the style of entertainment, which for which Paris was later known for. So she was one of the pioneers for Paris's more raunchier kind of dancing.
For burlesque and stuff.
Yeah, pretty much. So her style was free-willed attitude. And made Same. Her, yeah.
That's my style much. On the dance floor. Yeah. Free will attitude. Try and
yes,
stop
well,
me.
You like having your pants on.
Every now and then I drop a tip out, and it's by accident. So, yeah.
Yes, well, she was very popular because of this. Yes. And, yeah, her eagerness to perform in exotic and revealing clothing. She posed for provocative photos and mingled with in the wealthier circles. Mind you, she very rarely took her top off. A lot of the time she just was left in like jeweled bra because she had a thing about having tiny titties.
Okay, fair enough.
Yeah, yeah. She'll show everything else, just not tiny titties. So, yeah, so most of the Europeans at the time were unfamiliar with the Dutch East Indies. So Mata Hari was thought of as exotic, and it was assumed her claims were genuine.
Where did you say she was from again?
She's Dutch.
Yeah, she would have looked like it.
No, actually, she doesn't.
Oh.
Yeah, she's got the dark hair. She's got the skin. She could pass for mixed with Indian, I would say.
And especially for people back in those times who didn't have what we have, you couldn't just, you know, find people that had similar looks or anything like that. If you looked a bit different, you're exotic.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
So, yeah, she wasn't a typical Dutch-looking woman of the time. That's probably how she managed to get away with it. She was quite pretty, but, yeah. So one French journalist wrote in a Paris newspaper that Mata Hari was so feline, extremely feminine, majestically tragic, 1,000 curves and movements of her body trembling in 1,000 rhythms.
I have been described as majestically tragic on a dance floor.
Yeah. No, that's just tragic. Not even majestically tragic.
Not me, though. I'm always majestic.
Always. One journalist in Vienna wrote after seeing one of her performances that Mata Hari was slender and tall with the flexible grace of a wild animal and with blue-black hair and that her face marks a strange foreign impression. So by 1910, there was all sorts of freaking imitators that had come out. Like, yeah, we can all do this. And critics have become to openly criticize her dancing, calling her a cheap exhibitionist and saying that she lacks artistic merit.
What?
Yeah, because... Dicks. Well, these are, like, the people that are doing this are professional dancers, so your ballerinas and whatnot.
Yeah.
Yeah, so see, this is the thing. They've been, these are the sorts of people who comment on this sort of thing because they've been dancing their whole lives and they're making probably a quarter of what she's making in a night over a year. So, yeah, they're pissed off.
Yeah, and because her career actually started to go into decline after 1912, on the 13th of March 1915, that performance would be her last. She'd actually begun her career as a dancer quite late. I mean, she'd already had two children.
Yeah.
So, yeah, and she would start to put on, you know, as you get older, you start to put on weight.
Dirty's are a bitch, mate.
Yeah. So that would be her last performance. However, by this time, she had become a successful courtesan, high-end hooker. Gotta love them. So she was, known for her sensuality and eroticism more than her beauty. She had relationships with high-ranking military officers, politicians, and other influential positions in many different countries. And her relationships and liaisons with powerful men frequently took her across international borders. And that was before World War One. She was generally viewed as an artist and a free-spirited bohemian.
Goddamn hippie.
Yeah. But as war approached, she began to be seen as a wanton and promiscuous woman and who's perhaps a dangerous seductress.
Ooh.
Yeah. So because she was so free-spirited, that goes back to the time when she, you know, went, well, if I can't have my teacher flirt with me, then fuck you, I'm running away.
Oh, God.
During World War One, the Netherlands had remained neutral. And as a Dutch citizen, she was then able to cross national borders freely to avoid battlefields and such. She travelled between France and the Netherlands via Spain and Britain, and her movements attracted attention. During the war, she was involved in what was described as a very intense romantic sexual relationship with Captain Vadim Vasilov. And he was...
nailed it.
Yeah. I think I nailed it. I don't know. He was 23 years old. He was a Russian pilot serving with the French, who she called the love of her life. So... in the summer of 1916, Vasilov was actually shot down and badly wounded during a dogfight with the Germans, losing sight in his left eye. So Matahari had actually asked for permission to go visit her wounded lover at the hospital where he was staying near the front. As a citizen of a neutral country, she would not normally be allowed near the front, but... she was met from the French external military intelligence, who told her that if she would she would be allowed to go see him if she'd agree to spy for the French.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah. So she was sent to Germany to try and seduce Crown Prince Wilhelm to obtain inside military information or any of Germany's plans. So on her way there in November of 1916, she was arrested in Cornwall in England and taken up to London, where she was interrogated. After a while, she eventually admitted to working for the French, and she was released and she ended up staying at the Savoy. Later, she travelled to Madrid, where she met up with German Major Arnold Kalil. I don't know how to say his name. Kale? Is it Kale?
I don't know. Yeah.
Sure, let's call him Kale. He can be green and leafy.
Kales.
No one likes kale. And asked if he could arrange a meeting with Prince. So during this period, Matahari had apparently offered to share French secrets with Germany in exchange for money. Though, this was like in order to try and meet the Prince. But the thing is, he actually didn't know anything. He really didn't.
Well, it's because there's another man in her life and they all seem to be fucking useless at this point.
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah, but the royal family during many war times don't tend to have a hands-on approach. That's why Elizabeth and her sister got so much kudos during World War II, is because they went out and worked in the hospitals.
Yeah.
Yeah, that is true. That is true.
Well, in January of 1917, Major Kale, let's just call him Major Kale, transmitted a radio message to Berlin describing the helpful activities of a German spy codename H-21, whose biography clearly matched or closely matched Matahari's. And it was potentially obvious that the French thought it was obvious that Agent H-21 could only be Matahari. So the French Bureau intercepted the message, and from this message they said, yep, that's her. The messages were all in code that the German intelligence knew had already been broken by the French, suggesting that the messages were contrived to have her arrested by the French. It is said that the chief intelligence officer of the German army had grown very annoyed that she had provided him with no intelligence worthy of the name, instead selling the Germans mere Paris gossip about the sex lives of French politicians and generals, and decided to terminate her employment and exposed her as a German spy to the French.
What?
So yeah. She didn't know anything either. See, this is like your classic freaking like Blackadder or something along those lines. Everyone's running around pretending to be spies, but no one fucking knows anything.
Exactly. All she wanted to do was go visit her lover. That's all she wanted to go do.
Just and the French are like, man.
Yeah, and the French are like, actually, can you just go seduce that man over there and just see what he knows? And then the Germans are like, well, I'll let you go see that man over there if you tell me what those French people. And she's like, I know nothing.
I just want to see my man. I don't know anything. Fuck.
Sergeant Holt, I know nothing. So, yeah. So in December 1916, the second bureau of the French Foreign Ministry let Matahari obtain the names of 6 Belgium agents. 5 were suspected of submitting fake material and working for the Germans, while the 6th was suspected of being a double agent for Germany and France. 2 weeks after she had left Paris for the trip to Madrid, the double agent that they had let slip was executed by the Germans, while the 5 others continued their operations. This development served as proof to the second bureau that she was, in fact, communicating with the Germans. So on 13th of February...
It's a bit of a stretch, sorry.
It's a bit of a stretch.
I'm okay. Really trying to just keep my mouth shut. I'm like, where's this going?
No. A lot of it is a bit of a stretch. Like, their whole case was a bit of a stretch.
Look, I love a delusion as much as the next bitch here, but really? So
she was arrested in her room at the Hotel Elise Palace, and she was put on trial, accused of spying for Germany and consequently causing the death of at least 50,000 soldiers.
Again, that's a stretch.
Come on,
she sounds like a scapegoat here.
Well, although the French and British intelligence suspected her of spying for Germany, neither could produce definite evidence against her.
Jesus Christ.
Yeah. Hang on a second.
Yeah, because that didn't fucking happen. Oh, you know, I've now had too much wine shut in my mouth. And, well, they can't.
Right?
Yes.
God. This poor woman, all she wants to do is see her lover.
She just wants to shake her boobies for lots of money and see her man. Like, why was this hard? Why did you have to get involved?
I'm actually skipping over most of the trial because they pretty much just used her as a scapegoat. It is literally that. Their own incompetence, they're like, shit, we're pretty incompetent, but we can't let people know it. It was her. We're blaming her.
Lawyers are a bit shit like that.
No, because it was fucking easy to blame a woman. You couldn't go blaming a man. Oh, no. Like, that wouldn't fucking work because it's a man.
She was a woman of ill fame, remember, at the time. Yeah. So she made money by being a prostitute and shaking her boobies to rich people. So.
And she technically wasn't divorced, like, properly divorced yet.
Oh, she was at that point.
She was at this point.
Yeah. It's not the point, though. At this point,
she was properly divorced.
Okay. She was of ill fame because that sort of entertainment was, you know, very low rent.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it still is regarded quite that way. But,
and it probably should for the patrons. But at the time, she was entertaining rich people.
Yeah.
That's a bit shit when I
think. Well, they called her a femme fatale, a dangerous, seductive woman who uses her sexuality to I can't even say it. I should give up. Should I give up? Should this be the end of my segment?
Effortlessly manipulate men.
Thank you.
I'm helping.
What she just said. Whereas her lawyer actually turned around and said she was more naive and was easily manipulated by men.
Oh, for fuck's sake.
In order to
He's
help.
Not helping.
Well, he was trying to help her, but it didn't really helping. Work.
Because there actually was a good defense for the time is that she didn't know what she was doing. She's being manipulated by people who outrank her. So
She's just a woman. What does she know?
Yeah, that's actually probably the best defense they could have gone with at that time.
Yeah. So she actually wrote several letters to the Dutch ambassador in Paris claiming her innocence, which I will read. My international connections are due to my work as a dancer, nothing else. Because I really did not spy. It is terrible that I cannot defend myself. The most terrible and heartbreaking moment. That's what she wrote there. So then the most terrible and heartbreaking moment for Mata Hari during the trial occurred when her lover. Oh, yes, that's right. Her lover comes back into it.
He's
that's
back. Love.
Yes, he's back. So he comes back. He is a little bit, you know, depressed because he lost his eye during combat. And he declined to testify for her, telling her that he did not care if she was convicted or not.
But what would he have to – hang on a minute. What would he have to say? What evidence can he give? I'm a bit confused about why he was even there.
Because he was her lover.
Yeah, but
and she wanted to go see him.
Yeah, but he didn't know any of that. He was in a hospital losing his eye.
Yeah, well. But, yeah, he didn't care. He didn't care if she was convicted or not. Sorry, you were just a fling for me.
I kind of understand what he's saying.
I'm going to go over here and be a pirate with my one eye.
I kind of understand, though, because when you think about it, he probably wasn't even told her actual true intentions of what she was doing. He was probably just told, oh, no, she's a spy now, and she's just gone and rooted the whole countryside just to try and get information. And then she got caught. What do you want? He probably didn't hear what her side of the story, I dare say.
Wow. Stop standing up for him.
Yeah.
Just saying, you don't know.
Well, it was reported that she fainted when she learnt that he had abandoned her. She was just mortified. So she was, of course, found guilty and was sentenced to death. And she was executed by a firing squad of 12 French soldiers just before dawn on the 15th of October, 1917. She was 41, according to eyewitnesses' account by British reporter Henry Wales, she was not bound and she refused a blindfold. And then she blew a kiss to her firing squad.
Thank you, people.
In the record of her death, it is said that after the volley of shots rang out, she slowly settled on her knees. Her head was always up. And without the slightest change of expression on her face, which I figure would be a really hard thing to do, being shot. Apparently, yeah, and for a fraction of a second, it seemed like she tottered there on her knees, gazing directly at those who had just taken her life. Then she fell backwards, bending at the waist with her legs doubled up beneath her. A non-commissioned officer then walked over to her body, pulled out his revolver and shot her in the head just to make sure she was dead.
Yeah, don't want no zombie Mata Haris just running around.
Yeah. So her body was not claimed by any family members and was accordingly used for medical studies.
Oh.
Yes, her head was embalmed and kept at the Museum of Autonomy in Paris.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. In 2000, archivists discovered that it had disappeared, possibly early in the 1954, around that time. According to curator Roger Saban, during the museum's relocation, her head remains missing. Records dated from 1918 show that the museum also received the rest of her body, but none of the remains could later be accounted for.
They still lose shit all the time, though. So
yeah, so they lost her head and then they lost her body. So hey, maybe she's off with James Dean's car.
I was just gonna say that I reckon she's just like hooked up to her formaldehyde machine and she's sitting in James Dean's car in some billionaire's fucking basement.
Maybe. But yeah, so that's my story of Matahari, a woman who started off as married with two children, decided to become an exotic dancer who started the movement for exotic dancing, and then was executed as a spy for Germany.
Good work, Sarah.
Thank you.
Yeah. I felt like that went for very long and my mouth just wasn't using words.
What happens to me for editing? Wine anymore.
I have no excuse.
No.
Maybe the wine helped. Who knows?
You had less bucks when you had more wine, so yeah.
True. Okay, Amy, what have we got?
Hey guys, Amy here. I just wanted to let you all know that we have set up a Buy Me a Coffee account. What is Buy Me a Coffee, you ask? Well, it's a platform where you can donate as little as the cost of a coffee to our podcast. Your donation will go towards the running costs of this podcast. Our goal is to reach $480, which is the yearly cost of our platform host, Buzzsprout. You can find the link to our Buy Me a Coffee page on our socials, Twitter, Tumblr, Facebook, and Instagram, or at our blog, which is www.fridaynightwinefight.blogspot.com or at www.buymeacoffee.com/FNWF podcast. Thanks so much for listening. Now on with the show. My turn. All right. Tonight, I am going to discuss the life of Nancy Wake, otherwise known as the White Mouse. Strap in, because like Sarah's, this is a long one. But trust me, it's so worth it.
Bitches are killing me.
Yeah. It's so worth it, trust me. And I'll move fast.
I'm the one editing, so.
Yeah. No, Sarah's bit went for an hour. Let's do this.
All right. So, Nancy was born in New Zealand in 1912 and was the youngest of six children. The family moved to Australia when Nancy was young, and Nancy's father was working as a journalist. He left the family shortly after moving to Australia. Now, he was a bit of an ass. He told them he was returning to NZ to shoot a film, and then he just never came back. What was worse is he bloody sold the family home in Sydney, turfing Nancy's mother and all the children out into the street. Yeah.
Oh, what a cunt. Why is there so many cunts?
There's less cunts. I'll keep moving. Okay. Nancy left school at the age of 16 to become a nurse. That career was short-lived because she decided to leave Australia at the age of 20 and travel to Europe. So she moved to England, and then she settled in Paris where she was working as a freelance journalist. Sorry. Now I can't get words together. Fuck.
Okay. It's contagious. I'm sorry.
Fucking hell.
Damn, I'm so scared for my papers.
This is a good bit. So Nancy bluffed her way into her job as a journalist by telling her boss, the newspaper executive, that she was fluent in Egyptian. She wrote shorthand gibberish on a piece of paper and passed it off as language.
What? That sounds like Sarah speaking South Korean.
It's like Sarah trying to do this podcast. Yeah.
Yeah.
Like me trying to do the podcast. I think my Korean's better than my English at the moment.
Yeah, so she was eventually sent to Paris as a European correspondent, where she was known to live the life, the Parisian nightlife to its absolute fullest. Oh, yes, she was a party girl. Loved it. In 1936, she met a Marseille industrious named Henri Fiocca, who she married 3 years later. She was living a fairly luxurious life when World War II broke out. Nancy decided to drive an ambulance in Marseille because there was no ambulances in Marseille at the time. And she decided, well, they don't have an ambulance. I'm going to drive an ambulance. So she told her husband, I'm going to buy an ambulance and I'm driving it. And then she did. Yeah. So she's pretty headstrong.
As you do.
Yeah. She then began to work with the French resistance groups, helping the Allied soldiers flee from France to Spain. She told an Australian journalist that it was much easier for a woman back then. A woman could get out of trouble a lot easier than a man. The Germans got wind of what was going on, though, and in 1943, she also fled to Spain. This involved hiding in a coal truck and then jumping from a moving train while the Nazis were firing at her. Oh, yeah, fun times. Yeah. And so then she made passage to London. Her husband actually remained in France because he was a French industrialist and his family were quite prominent in Marseille. So he wanted to look after the business because at that point it hadn't really, really broken out at that point. Like it was interrupting things. He didn't see the need to flee. He thought he could hold the fort, basically. that's what he thought he could do. And yeah, unfortunately he was captured and tortured over Nancy's location and eventually was executed.
Oh.
Yeah. While in London, Nancy was accepted for training by the British Special Operations Executive, so the SOE for short, which was an intelligence group working for the French Resistance, or working with the French Resistance, I should say. In 1944, when she was 31, she was amongst 39 women and 430 men who parachuted into France to help prepare for D-Day. During her time as an SOE operative, Nancy developed a reputation as a deadly fighter and a relentless drinker. Yeah. She described to an Australian journalist a time where she killed a German sentry with her bare hands. She said, and I quote, "They taught us this judo chop stuff, and I practiced away at it, but there was only one time I ever used it." Yeah. She smoked cigars. She drank guerrilla fighters under the table in drinking bouts. The story goes is that she was deployed to the forests of France by the SOE to lead thousands of French resistance fighters with the British. Now, the French resistance leaders were not happy about this, complaining, "What is this? They send this a woman." Yeah, they were not happy. They're not happy, Jan.
That was a good French accent. I love it.
I don't do accent very well at all. I try, but my French is actually not bad. So
it was amazing for a cartoon character.
Right? From the 30s or something.
From
yeah.
the 30s, yeah.
When they didn't understand accents. Anyway, yeah. So what she did to win over these men was she sat the heads of the resistance down with bottles of booze that she'd smuggled in from London. And she left that night being the last person standing. And after that, she had their respect and they followed her and they did what they were told. Yeah. Drank them under the table. A colleague of hers once said, "She's the most feminine woman I know until the fighting starts and then she's like five men." It was rumored that despite the war, she didn't travel anywhere without her Chanel lipstick, her face cream and her red satin cushion. Yeah. So bitch had standards. Oh, I appreciate that.
Yes. You definitely need face cream and a satin cushion because it stops you from getting those creases in your face while you sleep.
And your lipstick, because it gets cold in the winter in France, right? Yeah. So that doubles as lip balm.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sure and you that. Never know when you're going to need to look pretty.
Or not need to look pretty, just want to feel pretty. I just want to feel, I've just been in the fucking ditch all day with all these stinky bastards.
I just killed several people. I just need to feel pretty right now.
Just want to feel pretty. Yeah,
I haven't bathed in like 2 weeks. I just need to feel pretty.
Just need to feel pretty. Yeah. When communication lines were down, she volunteered to cycle long distances to retrieve radio codes. I read one article that said that one journey was over 500 kilometres, which she did in 72 hours.
Jesus Christ.
Yeah, I went, that's actually not possible. I calculated it is totally possible. But she slept for like maybe 5 hours a day. Yeah, maybe had a little bit of downtime.
Probably
anyway,
a little bit.
When she said when she finished the journey that they asked if she was okay, and apparently she just cried. She couldn't stand up. She couldn't sit down. She just cried. I'm like, feel
my ass was sore.
Right?
Oh, my God. Remember when we did Relay for Life?
Right? It was basically that. Couldn't
All I did was a marathon. I did like 40 Ks.
Yeah. Couldn't stand up. Couldn't sit down. Yeah, just was not okay. So she basically did anything she could to help the French resistance. Another quote from her was speaking about going on dates with German soldiers to get information. And it goes like this: "A little powder, a little drink on the way, and I'd pass their posts. I'd wink and I'd say, 'Do you want to search me?' God, what a flirtatious little bastard I was." Oh, yeah, we've all been there.
Yeah.
She led attacks on arms factories, and that's where she killed the sentry. And famously, she led an attack on a German headquarters in Montluçon. I think that's how you say it in France. So that was actually a big get for the British, and she was the one that actually led the attack. So that was really interesting. Three French women were brought to her attention for possibly being spies. Now, they were being used as prostitutes by the Marquis. So the Marquis were the French resistance fighters in Germany at the time. These were the people that she was working with. Nancy discovered these prostitutes, ordered that they be set free, and she provided them clothes and allowed them to wash. However, she was pretty suspicious of them, and under her interrogation, she was convinced two were not spies, but one was. Nancy ordered the third woman's death by firing squad, and this is what she said about the situation. I was not a very nice person, but it didn't put me off my breakfast. After all, she got an easy death. She didn't suffer. I knew her death would be a lot better than the one I would have got. If I hadn't have done it and she got away and reported this to the Germans what the Mackays were up to, how could I have ever faced the families of the Mackayards we lost because of it? I definitely knew I was doing the right thing.
That is such an Aussie saying, didn't put me off for breakfast.
I just love this. I feel like this needs to go on my tombstone. I wasn't a very nice person, but didn't put me off my breakfast because bitches love breakfast. So, yeah.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Some crumpets from the toaster in your room. Yeah.
Right. Just love breakfast. Anyway, she became so notorious to the Germans that they named her the White Mouse because she managed to escape capture at every turn. They put a bounty on her head of 5 million francs at the time. This was like in 1943.
That's huge.
I tried to do the conversion and I could not find a calculator that I was convinced was right. Yeah. But they never got her, though. After the war, she was awarded the following honours. The Companion of the Order of Australia, the George Medal, the 1939 to 1945 star, the France and Germany star, the Defence Medal, the War Medal for service between 1939 and 1945. That's different to the 1939 to 1945 star for anybody who's interested in war stuff. I think it's Cavalier de la Legion d'Honneur, it's French, Officer de la Légion d'Honneur. So that was because she was an officer. The Croix de la I can't remember how you say that one. The Medal of Freedom, the Medaille de la Résistance, and the Badge in Gold, which is actually NZ's highest honour, and it was presented to her in 2006. Now, she didn't get all of these honours when the war finished. Some she was actually presented with a lot later in her life. After the war, Nancy returned to Australia and stood as a political candidate for the Liberal Party in 1949, but it was unsuccessful. She actually stood a couple of times, but in this particular instance, she lost the seat of Barton in Sydney, which is actually a very prestigious seat. It's like the main seat in Sydney, I think.
Yeah.
And she actually lost it to the then deputy prime minister, but only by 250 votes. So it's not many at all. Yeah, she did pretty well, I think. After being unsuccessful at her run for office, she decided to leave Australia in 1951 and she returned to the UK and worked as an intelligence officer for the Air Force. She met an Australian Air Force officer and she married him. They returned to Australia where they stayed for 40 years and Nancy's second husband sadly passed away in 1997. They did not have any children. Nancy returned to England in 2001 and she sold her war medals to fund her lifestyle, saying there was no point keeping them. And another amazing quote from Nancy. I'll probably go to hell and they'll melt anyway. Yeah.
I love that. Same.
So she was also pretty annoyed that her war efforts were not recognised in Australia until a lot later, and she believed it was because she was a woman. Many people actually backed this up and said it was because she was a woman. And B, people told her she shouldn't sell her medals because it was an honour to get them. In a TV segment that I've watched, I'm going to put a link to this. It's only 10 minutes. It's from the ABC, I think, in Australia. Watch it. It's so good. She went on an epic rant about why she's not leaving her medals to the War Museum in Canberra. Yeah, epic rant. Was really good.
Have to watch it. I'm so keen to watch it. I'll do it tomorrow.
So
after
she went back to the UK, she became a resident of the Stafford Hotel in St. James Place, which was previously a service person's bar. In the mornings, she would usually be found in the hotel bar, sipping a gin and tonic, telling war stories. She had her own chair in the corner of the bar, and it had a nameplate on it. And if anyone sat in her corner, she told them to get out. Yeah.
More likely she went, fuck off, mate.
Oi, mate, get out of my chair.
Back off. Yeah. I don't know. Would she still have her New Zealand accent? I don't know. Nah,
she was only two when she left NZ. Yeah, and she didn't
I left NZ at one, and when I'm real drunk, feck off.
Yeah, this is true.
Or if
you've been hanging around your family too much.
I know, right?
It's true. The owners of the bar actually ended up absorbing most of the costs of her stay because they liked her. That was one story. However, there is another story that Prince Charles was actually told about Nancy when he met a Canadian diplomat one day, and he must have been talking about her book or something along those lines. So Prince Charles was intrigued and got a copy of her book and went over to the hotel to meet her. And then after that, apparently it was actually Prince Charles that paid the rest of her way in life. Yeah, he was picking up the bar tab.
Nice. Yeah.
And I think it was probably because he also served, and his mother and his aunt served, and Philip served. Yeah. So
royal family.
Yeah, yeah. And I think he probably just thought to himself, well, you know what? She served for the British in World War II. We should look after her. I really hope that many other British people who served in the war were looked after in such a fashion, but I dare say they weren't. So
yeah.
Anyway. She had many film and television producers approach her about using her life as a basis for various works. Mostly she approved them, but she did have one rule. She did not approve of the ones depicting her having love affairs during the war. Yeah, she said she didn't have love affairs during the war and regretted it in her old age. She said, but you see, if I had have accommodated one man, the word would have spread and then I'd have to accommodate the whole damn lot.
Right? It's a hefty price to pay.
Now, this is the kicker. So she wasn't aware that her first husband died until quite some time after the war. So, like, they looked for him and they couldn't find him, and then she found out what happened to him. So the whole time she was in France and she was saying she was going on dates and things like that, she maintains that she didn't cheat on her husband that because she thought he was still alive. And that's why she said she didn't have love affairs during the war, and in her old age she regretted it because her husband was dead, she didn't know. So yeah, fair enough.
Yeah,
yeah.
And that was all too commonplace. Like even today, it's quite a bit of time between the death and the family finding out, simply because it's hard.
Yeah.
Like, if you can't find the person, how do you presume them dead?
Exactly. And he was executed by the Germans, so he was probably missing for a long time. She was hoping that he was hiding somewhere. Yeah. I don't know.
Exactly. And they didn't have Sky robots like they do today.
Exactly.
Like, yeah, we got Skynet and shit like that now. So
exactly.
Yeah.
She was actually pretty critical of a TV miniseries that was made about her. She didn't actually approve this one. And it shows her cooking eggs and bacon for all the men. And she said, for goodness sake. Did the Allies parachute me into France to fry eggs and bacon for the men? There wasn't an egg to be had for love nor money. And if there had been, why would I be frying it when I had men to do that sort of thing?
Fucking A.
Yeah.
Yes. She was an officer.
Yeah.
For the men.
Yeah. Oh, she had subordinates. There were literally people who are paid to be chefs in the army.
Yeah.
Why would she be cooking?
And even if you were in places where you're holed up in burnt out houses or bunkers and stuff like that, if you didn't have a cook and there was food, because I mean, that's the thing, there wasn't food. If you didn't have a cook, they just found whoever was the lowest ranking officer to try and make something. That's how the Army and the Navy and the Air Force work. If you don't have someone to do the job, you make the shit kicker do it, obviously.
Exactly. Throughout time. Anyway, that's how it works.
That's how it works, people. In 2003, she moved into a nursing home for ex-service people where she remained until 2011, where she passed away at the age of 98. Now, I have read nearly every article I could get my hands on about this woman, and I can't believe of all the war stuff we were taught in school, we have never heard of this person.
Yeah.
Why?
Yes.
Huh? Yeah.
She's engaging. She's interesting. She has an incredible tale to tell. How are we not hearing about this?
Yeah.
I don't get it. Anyway, in fact, Nancy's efforts in the war were not recognised by Australia, her home country, until decades after the war. So this is just kind of a bit shit. Mm. So there's really good interviews with Nancy online. I particularly enjoyed a segment on the ABC, which I mentioned before, and I will put up the YouTube link in the blog. And for my ladies, it's in my forest sheet, so it's there. Look it up. This woman's incredible. I like to consider myself someone who's a bit of a badass and has forged a pretty good life for myself after enduring some, let's just call them, interesting times of my life. However, this woman's incredible and I'm completely in awe. Nancy Wake, you are amazing, and I will be buying a copy of your autobiography. Yeah, she wrote her own biography. There's biographies written about her, but she actually wrote one of her own, so I'll be definitely reading that.
Oh, okay. Cool.
And I will think of you and your sacrifice often, because this has really hit me. I was actually blown away by this. I couldn't. It was just incredible. And the fact that she was witty and funny in amongst all this stuff, I just, I think I'm in love, guys.
Fair enough.
Yeah. All right, Bianca, what have you got?
Oh, well, mine's all shit now compared to your powerful ladies. Like, I just feel like I'm bringing girl power way down over here.
No, so, that's okay. Men represent. We're an equal opportunity show here.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Well, when I started thinking originally our topic was secret aliases, which we changed to secret identities because aliases was too pigeonholy, whereas secret identities opened it up. And my brain went on a completely different direction to everyone else, as does. And so I actually researched fictional secret identities over here. Yeah. Across some different media. So I had heaps. I had heaps about comics, cartoon, and stuff like that. And I've condensed it down and just picked a few. So I've got one from comics and the rest are from film. And I didn't go with TV. I mean, I literally could have gone with the TV show, Alias. But didn't.
It's a bit shit, by the way.
For obvious reasons. Yeah. Yeah. So for comics, I just picked this one and I picked this one for Amy. So because it was DC and Young Justice.
DC represent, y'all.
Yeah. Yeah. So Spy Boy's partner, Bombshell, attended his sleeper personalities high school under the name Mata Hari. Hey. Yeah, good on you, Bombshell.
Yeah.
So when Young Justice infiltrated the same high school, they used even more obvious aliases, right? So Robin enrolled himself as Rob Roy.
But wasn't that a cowboy?
Yeah.
Rob Roy a cowboy?
No, he's a Scottish guy, Rob Roy. Yeah. He's played by, like the movie Rob Roy. I don't know. Is it Daniel Day-Lewis? Is it? And that same comic, you've got Wonder Girl from Young Justice. She enrolled herself as Helena Troy. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. How many people did she get killed? Really?
I haven't read the comics. I've only ever seen bits of the TV, and I know Amy's seen most of the TV stuff.
Yeah.
So I'm going to crack on to film. So all of the aliases used on the name tags by the main characters in Fight Club are names from films, such as Taxi Driver, it was Travis, and Planet of the Ape, Cornelius. Love it. In Catch Me If You Can. And I love this because it's based on a true story. Frank Abagnale Jr. uses the alias Barry Allen, which is the secret identity of The Flash.
The Flash.
One of the guys on the case figures out that the person they're looking for is probably quite young based on this information, which is something they use in real life. I like that. Yeah.
Dad, have you ever seen that movie? He's not any sort of genius or anything like that. In fact, it's pure fucking luck that he escaped so many times. He's not a genius. He's not that smart.
Oh, but there are so many movies Leonardo DiCaprio's been in that I just think, fuck, where was your Oscar? Where was your Oscar? I'm banging my desk.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Fucking hell. Anyway, moving on. In Back to the Future, Marty's name is assumed to be Calvin Klein because that's the name of his underwear in the third movie. So also in that third movie, he adopts the name Clint Eastwood while he was stuck in the Old West. Yep.
But going by names on underwear, I think my name's Kmart.
Oh, same. Anko.
Yeah. Anko. Same.
We are all now Anko.
Which is very close. Very close to Unco, which is so true.
Which
so
is
true.
Accurate.
Way too accurate.
Yeah. Marty McFly also dresses up as an alien and calls himself Darth Vader. So that was great. This one I found interesting. So Austin Powers, international man of mystery. Austin and Vanessa, they meet number two at a casino, right?
Yeah.
Austin says to number two, "My name is Richie Cunningham and this is my lovely wife, Oprah." So this may have been a name, may have been names that popped into his head without knowledge of the cultural meaning, given his status as a human popsicle, and he missed everything.
I know. I picked this up when I first watched this, and I went, how would he have picked this up? This is
how
stupid. This is bad writing.
This is terrible. Yeah, I'm sorry, you really, like, jumped the shark. You nuked the fridge on that one, mate.
Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. So this is my next one. In Fletch. Now, I haven't seen Fletch in, it's been a hot minute, I tell you, ladies. I did like Fletch as a child. I thought it was very funny. In my mind, whenever I think of Fletch, I just picture him blackface as an Indian, like in the, like a Sarabi, rollerblading down Sunset Boulevard. I remember that scene vividly. like this turban. Like, he's got the wrap on and he's rollerblading. And, yeah, it's just terrible. Chevy Chase, what are you doing?
But when you told me you were doing Fletch, I was like, why don't we watch it? I remember that being on repeat when I was a kid. Like, why are we not at yet? You just described why we don't watch that anymore.
Yeah.
Have you not heard of Fletch?
Oh, my God. Fletch lives? Oh, my God. Okay, we need to do some sort of watch party. Anyway, so some of the aliases he uses in the movies. So the real people, he goes by Ted Nugent, Igor Stravinsky, Gordon Liddy, and Harry S. Truman. Some characters that he goes by in the movies, Babar, the elephant, Don Corleone. My favorite, and I think I vaguely remember these scenes, Dr. Rosenpenis. Just so stupid. The second Fletch film, Fletch Lives, Fletch uses the alias Elma Fudd Gantry.
Yes.
Combines the names of two fictional characters. Very well done. Good writers.
Oh, God.
In The Saint, which features Val Kilmer, all of Simon's aliases are the names of Catholic saints. Funnily
yes,
enough.
They are.
A real person name example from In the Line of Fire would be presidential assassin. Mitch Leary uses the name Booth, as in John Wilkes. When taunting Agent Frank Horrigan, who's a former JFK bodyguard, right, over the phone. This is and I've got the current conversation here. So Leary says, "Why not call me Booth?" Horrigan, "Why not Oswald?" And I love this so much. Leary says, "Because Booth had flair, panache, a leap to the stage after he shot Lincoln." I love that. Freaking right. Yep. It wasn't some fucking on the hill. Like.
My name's Grassy. Grassy Knoll.
Right. Oh, my God. Oh, I love this one because it's one of my favorite movies, right?
Yes.
In The Birdcage, the flamboyantly gay housekeeper is pretending to be a stereotypical butler and he introduces himself as Spartacus.
Oh, God. I don't wear the shoes. I said that for so long. I've just seen that movie. I don't wear the shoes. Yeah.
This next one was one that I found, but I don't actually have any reference for it because I actually don't think I've seen the movie, Generation X. I might have. But anyway, it was a made-for-TV movie. So Emma Frost passed herself and Banshee off as Hootie and the Blowfish, right, to a police officer. But not just like any Hootie and the Blowfish, they're like agents Hootie and Blowfish. And apparently it was okay because Emma had messed with the guards my side. I've got like wine hiccups. Just let me breathe for like 2 seconds. I've drunk so much while I've been waiting. Welcome to my nightmare. That was me the other week. In one of my favorites in the first Die Hard, John McClane decides that the name he'll use with Pal will be Roy after Roy Rogers, which McClane referred to in a previous scene, the one with his catchphrase. Mm-hmm.
Which one? There's several.
Yippee-ki-yay. It was actually yippee-ki-yay. In Shock Treatment, which I don't remember this either, but anyway, it turns out that Cosmo and Nation McKinley's are not real doctors. What? But character actors who use an assortment of last names, all of which are US presidents. Yes, in The Player, the blackmailer. Yeah, that guy with the back and he mails things.
Yeah,
that guy.
Much like the postman, but less Kevin Costner. So he uses aliases Joe Gillis. Oh no!
You're nearly there, mate. Come on.
I am. I'm so close. I'm 3 points away. Okay. So he uses the narrator, from Sunset Boulevard. But this is intentional because he knows the connotations that it'll rattle his target. My next one, the serial killers in The Devil's Rejects use the names of Groucho Marx characters. Oh, very interesting. Yeah, in Shakespeare in Love, Lord Wessex brings a knife to Shakespeare's throat and threatens him to stay away from his future wife, Viola de Lesseps. Wessex demands to know Shakespeare's name to deter any future meddling. Will uses the name Christopher Marlowe, the name of his chief competitor. In real life, Marlowe was actually murdered in mysterious circumstances. So that was very well done and put together.
Hmm.
And my last one is it's a bit of a throwaway one, so let's get into it. In Notting Hill, Julia Roberts' character, a famous actress playing a famous actress.
No.
Yeah, I know. It's not cliche. Let's calm down. Don't jump on it. She uses fake aliases taken from cartoon characters, so like Daisy Duck and shit like that, when she checks into her. Yeah.
As you do.
Yeah.
That's not a red flag. Yeah.
Personally, I check in as Elma 5 quite regularly.
There's no red flag. Only red doors. Yeah. And that is my secret identities. Yeah. Thank you. And good night. Wait, no, I've got to read the end.
You're going to read the end, mate.
I gotta keep going. Okay, so which is open my eyes. I had so much fun researching this topic as I did with the other topics over the last few weeks. However, we would like some topic suggestions from our listeners. If you have a topic which you would like us to discuss, oh fucking please email us.
Please.
I mean, we're not desperate, but we are desperate. Most of our topics are because I troll Jeopardy lists.
Yeah.
That's how we got this one. It was a secret aliases. I was like, yep, that sounds good. Sounds like a topic. Help us. FridayNightWiFi@gmail.com. And before I finish this up, I should plug the audio drama that I am on. Shameless plug.
I know.
I kept thinking, like, at the start of the episode, should Shameless plug this before I start talking? Did I remember? No. Nobody listens to this bit, so I'm just going to crap on here. Look, Val Toby, a Goldie Malone murder mystery. I am Laurie Malone. I debut in episode 3, which as of this recording is out. By the time you hear this, episode 4 will almost be out. Maybe even episode 5 if you're only just joining us. I don't know. But keep a listen out. I'm in it. It was so much fun. The side hustle that also made me no money, like this podcast. But I did have fun doing it.
And I have been listening because, well, I'm supportive like that.
Yes,
and yeah. The episodes are quite good. The story is quite intriguing. And the best part is they go for 6 minutes. So you can listen to them on the way to the shops.
Yeah, done. Yes. Very, very easy. Very palatable. Yeah, it's great. There is a season 2 coming in 2022. So, yeah.
For under people.
Yep. All right. So to everyone who's listened to this. We would like to thank each and every one of you for your time in listening to our utter, utter rubbish. We hope that you have found it entertaining and are not using any of the facts discussed in this recording. Unless it's sell your medals and move the fuck on with your life. Because fuck, don't let people tell you what to fucking do. Do what you want. It's none of their business.
If you want to shake your titties and make some money, bitch. Do it or mate, do it. Like, whoever you are, you could be male or female, just do it. Hate is going to hate.
Yeah. And yeah, as Salt and Pepper said back in 1993, ain't none of your business.
Amen.
All right. Thank you very much for listening. Peace out.
Bye.
Bye.